Welcome to another episode of the Mindfield podcast with your hosts, Kiri and Alexi. For those who haven't joined us before, a huge welcome and a big thank you for taking the time to listen. Now, the aim of the podcast is very simple. We're here to try and open up conversations around mental health and have some fun along the way. We interview all sorts of guests, and they include the famous and the not so famous. Seasons one and two have seen us host professional sportsmen, psychiatrists, entrepreneurs, artists, musicians, as well as straightforward, everyday people. We listen to their stories, delving a little deeper and hear their practical advice on how they've plotted their way through life. They all offer a unique take on what mental health is to them, how they've overcome their problems in the past, and how they've led happy and successful lives, even whilst battling their inner demons. They tell us how they've navigated their very own minefields. Now, today, I'm really happy and delighted to welcome Grace Kingswell. Grace is a clinical nutritional therapist with specialised interest in functional medicine and its approach to health. A bit more background on Grace is she's particularly interested in the field of gut health, skin disorders, toxicity, mold and mycotoxins, hormones and allergies. Quite a long list. Her passion for the healing power of food, mindset and lifestyle has led her to work with complex cases and chronic health issues such as SIBO or SIBO, thyroid disorders, chronic gut imbalances, eczema and psoriasis. She's been featured in Women's Health and also hosts her own podcast, State of Mind, that's ranked in Apple's top charts. It discusses how lifestyle interventions can have a profound effect and impact on our physiology. Tell you what, Grace, when I wrote that intro, I did not think I'd have so many difficult things to pronounce. I had psoriasis, SIBO, thyroid disorders, really difficult. But thank you so much for joining us.
You're so welcome. That was so nice to just be like read out all the things that I do and are sitting here feeling really smug.
Good. Alexia will know this, but I love interviewing other people who have a podcast because they know how everything works and they've got it all down. But at the same time, I also feel very intimidated because I'm sure you'll be judging back the other way. So hopefully we get it right and we don't miss too much.
No, I think it's very brave of you to record the intro live with me sitting here. I never do that with my guests. I just go straight into it and then I put the intro in and the outro when I'm by myself and I can do multiple takes.
Good. Well, to be honest, Alexia's got me to re-record some when I sort of get very stuck. And I was looking at psoriasis in particular and how it's spelled and thinking, oh my goodness, there's no way I'm going to be able to say it. But look, anyway, I don't want to take up too much more of your time. But I think firstly, I just wanted to ask, you know, obviously, thank you for coming on. And some of our best podcasts have been with experts, and we're talking about this offline, and people who really know their stuff and can offer some great, great advice. But I think first, it makes sense to start with you and your story and how you got into nutritional therapy and what it is, I guess, for those of us who don't know what it entails.
Yeah, so hi, I'm Grace Kingswell. As you said, I'm a nutritional therapist. I think the first thing to say is that there's a big distinction between nutritionist, which we've all heard of, and nutritional therapist, which we assume is the same thing. So as a nutritional therapist, I work with patients one-on-one who have really quite complex health issues. You know, they may have tried lots of routes already. They've been to their GP, they've seen specialists, and they've been put on a concoction of medicines, which, you know, really definitely help the symptoms of what they're dealing with. But at some point down the line, you know, the problem comes back. And what nutritional therapy does, especially when you work with the kind of functional medicine aspect of things as well. I'm not a member of the Institute for Functional Medicine. Hopefully one day I will be, but I work with a very functional approach and use functional testing. Is we're really looking to get to the root cause of what's causing someone to feel unwell. So for example, if you have eczema or if you have psoriasis, it's not just giving a topical steroid cream that's going to make it go away for the next few weeks. It's thinking, okay, well, what's happening on the body, in the body on a physiological level that's causing those symptoms? So another way of thinking about it is that it's root cause medicine. And that really is, in my opinion, the foundation to health, because if we can actually get to the root cause, we can figure out what's going on, we can treat that, we can improve that, and then the quality of life ultimately improves as well. So that's what nutritional therapy is. Obviously, there is a big emphasis on diet, and I talk about diet with all of my patients, but it's not, you know, coming to me and walking away with a meal plan. It's a lot more in depth than that. And I typically spend between an hour and a half and 2 hours with a new patient just talking about them and their life and you know, learning what makes them tick, and obviously understanding what they've been through in terms of their medical history, but also asking them, are you happy? Did you have a good childhood? You know, is there any trauma in your life? How are your relationships? What's your mood like on a daily basis? Are you sleeping well? Do you go outside? You know, all of these things make up that grander picture of health. So that's what nutritional therapy is. And with regards to my journey to this, I guess it starts with, and you know, people probably heard me bang on about it on other podcasts, but I actually don't really know any nutritional therapists that haven't had some sort of health battle themselves. I think that's what makes a lot of us very, very interested in the field and, you know, really feel like we want to help others in the same way that that particular practice has helped us. So I sort of just never really felt well growing up. I've always just been super tired and lacking in energy, and I really struggled at school to kind of keep up with everyone, and I had a really impeccable diet. You know, my mum brought me up super healthily. We ate lots of organic food, loads of veggies, and I always just felt really crap. And it was just really unfair to me. You know, my friends would go out on nights out, come home at 3 a.m, you know, get McDonald's on the way home and just be fine the next day and get on with it. And it would just completely ruin me for weeks. And I remember thinking back on it now, like I did always suffer with kind of gut issues. I remember just feeling like really uncomfortable in that area for many, many years. And then when I was sort of, I think 17, it kind of came to a head. I was on a language course in Spain for 2 weeks with a girlfriend because my goal was to study languages at uni, which I did end up doing. And I was just unbelievably sick, like the most sick I have, well, ever been at that point in my life, with just terrible, terrible, terrible pain in my stomach. You know, couldn't keep food down, really like on the loo all the time. And I just assumed, I was like, this must be something I'm eating, because as humans, you know, that's the tangible thing that, you know, we put food into our bodies. So it's really easy to assume that it's the root cause of everything. So I started thinking, oh, must be something I'm eating. You know, but looking back on it now, the pain was so much, it obviously wasn't the fact that I was having chocolate or like yogurt or, you know, just totally mental. And anyway, I came home from that and I sort of crawled through security at Gatwick on my hands and my knees, and I was rushed straight to A&E, where they realized that I had a lump on my ovary about the size of a grapefruit, an abscess, in fact. And I was in hospital for about 2 weeks. I dropped down to 7 stone, which for someone who's 5'9" is shockingly light. And I had an operation to drain the abscess and kind of clear up the infection. And at that stage, I just sort of walked out of the hospital and I was like, okay, cool. Like, you know, on with life, so to speak. And I continued to feel really low and tired and, you know, sort of unhappy. And I really enjoyed school, but there was just always something that just made me feel just not great. I kind of struggled a bit mentally. And then when I was 22, so about 4 years later, I just left Cambridge, where I'd spent 4 years working incredibly hard, but also having a lot of fun, but again, just struggling. I wound up in hospital again because one of my fallopian tubes was infected. And they told me that that needed to be removed. And so I kind of went under the knife again. And actually, when I woke up from that operation, they had decided that both tubes needed to be removed. So that was really tough for me, because obviously I walked in as a fertile woman and I left with absolutely no chance of conceiving children naturally ever again. And at the tender age of 22, that was unbelievably difficult to deal with, and actually still probably haven't dealt with it, because it was just a lot easier to just park it, sideline it, and then continue with life. And it was kind of around that time, like maybe 24, 25, where I was, you know, I was still just feeling awful. And I remember like my gut symptoms had got so bad that I was struggling to socialize because I knew that I would be in absolute agony trying to hold in farts. Sorry, but that's the truth. And I was just so exhausted, and I thought I have to do something about this. So I went to see a functional medicine practitioner who's also a naturopath, and I started to work with her, and we did a lot of tests, and we figured out that I had SIBO, small intestine bacterial overgrowth, which is an overgrowth of bacteria in the small intestine that's supposed to be in the large intestine. It's migrated and it's got there somehow, and it causes all of these gut symptoms and fatigue and brain fog. And it suddenly all started to make sense, like why I had a terrible memory and I couldn't remember anything. Yeah. And my energy was so low and I had terrible eczema. You know, it was all stemming, a lot of it was stemming from this chronic gut imbalance that I had. And that sort of started the journey of healing, really. And a lot of other things cropped up along the way. You know, it wasn't as simple as healing the SIBO. I then developed like really bad histamine intolerance, where any kind of food I was eating would make me react. And my eyes would swell up, and the eczema got so much worse, and the tiredness. And it was just years and years and years of feeling absolutely crap. But somewhere in the middle of that, I met my husband busking on Portobello Road. I saw him performing and I thought, oh, he's quite easy on the eye and very talented, and struck up a relationship. And he is Australian, and we decided to move to Australia together for a year. And it was when I was in Australia that things started to get really, really bad, and they started to unravel again. And I'd done so much good work with this practitioner, and it all kind of got worse, and came back from that year feeling absolutely rubbish, and just kept working hard at it, kept chipping away. And, you know, bit by bit, slowly, 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 I'm now about to turn 30. And I'd say it's probably only in the last year, year and a half, that I've started to feel what I would call normal. But it was whilst we were in Australia that I decided that I wanted to learn to be a nutritional therapist. You know, I was so fascinated. Everything that this practitioner was saying to me made so much sense. And I thought, this is what I'm really interested in, because I studied languages at uni, but like so many people, I just did a degree and I didn't ever want to be a linguist. Yeah. Or do anything with those languages. So when we were in Australia, I started studying, and it was a 3-year diploma course. And then since then, I've done loads of additional therapies and training, most recently a year with a functional medicine mentoring program. I've done some traditional Chinese medicine acupuncture, and just sort of like expanded my knowledge and added strings to my bow. And now I'm really happy to say that I see loads of patients on a monthly basis. And I always approach those consultations with a huge level of compassion and understanding, because like I said, most people in this profession have been through something themselves, and that's what makes it, you know, so rewarding and so relatable for the people that we treat. So I guess that's kind of it. Yeah, long story,
but quite an amazing story. And I'm glad there's a happy ending. I think it was quite up and down. Actually, I didn't know a lot of that about you, so it's quite eye-opening. And it's staggering how many of the people we interview and who come on, and you might have seen the same, who do have the personal angle that almost makes them maybe not better at their jobs, but also gives them the ability to show compassion. Yeah. And I imagine, especially in your line of work, where people come to you with almost what they see as intractable problems, ones that they have just tried everything. And what's staggering is clearly someone like you who has known or been aware of it for so long. It's taken you, what, 9, 10, 11, I don't know how many, but almost double figures years to sort it. One thing I want to ask about how you go about treating people, and I probably know the answer to this question, but I imagine that no one is the same. No two cases are the same. Do you have to spend a lot of time getting to know a patient or someone that comes to see you before you can start working out exactly what's going to fix them?
Yeah, definitely. And that's something that I try and make clear. I probably haven't made it clear enough on my website, but I try and make clear if I have a discovery call with a patient, that actually, you know, they're not just going to walk away from that first consultation with a prescription for some supplements that are going to make them feel better. Yeah. You know, actually, when you work like this and you're trying to get to the root cause of something, it can take ages, you know, it can take years, depending on how complex the case is. And, you know, like you were saying, you do have to spend a lot of time getting to know someone, because all of those factors, like their mental health, or, you know, the people that they surround themselves with, their attitude towards their health, their relationship with their diet and their body, and how they treat themselves, you know, the quality of sleep that they're having, whether they're in a happy or unhappy relationship, you know, what their childhood was like. It's all really, really important. It's not just, okay, what are your symptoms right now? This is what we're going to do about it.
Yeah.
So you have to kind of unravel and unpick so much. And I think sometimes that comes as a shock to people. And some people take to it really well. You know, that I actually, in terms of the way I treat patients, the initial consultation is always my favorite, because I just sort of take a step back and I might prompt people, but they just tell me how they're feeling. And it's so interesting. I have a really, quite a comprehensive intake questionnaire that I would have always sent to people in advance, and that, you know, they'll tick boxes as to what their symptoms are, and they'll do a 4-day food diary for me. So I know a little bit about them already, but there's always stuff that comes up, and no one is ever expecting it to either. I think that's what's so interesting, is that, you know, the things that people think aren't relevant and they tend to leave out are the things that I really want to know about. So sometimes, like, you being a bit of a detective and trying to encourage them to spill the beans on pretty much every aspect of their life.
That's it, because it's all interlinked, I guess, and you've alluded to it. You're not a sleep coach, you're not a breathwork coach, but you kind of put it all together and you say, well, actually, it's not just one thing. And I imagine there is no quick fix, and this stuff all takes time.
I am actually a breathwork coach, but that aside, you are right. Yeah, it takes time.
It's interesting, and I don't want you to have to talk in sort of generalizations, but I guess one thing I would ask is, what do you see as most common when you face patients? I know that everyone is different, and that's why I asked you that question first, because I did want to make sure people are aware. But I guess what sort of the most common things that you see, and what are the best tips that you'd give to someone who struggles with diet, maybe, but also has just general bad health? You know, they're tired all the time, or they're struggling. I know, no one's going to hold you to this, but it's just interesting to hear your views on sort of managing a healthy and balanced diet generally.
So, I think that's a really good question, because there are a few things that I do talk about with every patient. And actually, the reason I do that is because, you know, the basics and the fundamentals are always the place to start for me, and have so, so, so much value. Sometimes I get patients who have, you know, they've exhausted other areas of treatment. They might have seen a crazy expensive functional medicine doctor in London who's done some testing and just, you know, given them like hormone replacement, or given them something, you know, quite hefty, and they've gone away and it's made them feel worse. And the reason that that's happened is because the basics weren't in place. So, you know, diet, gut health, sleep, stress. And one thing that I do find myself talking a lot about with everyone is sugar in their diet, and the importance of having a balanced blood sugar. Because so often I see on people's food diaries that they are really, really reliant on the next snack or the next coffee, or, you know, even if it's like that quote unquote healthy snack, you know, the nut butter date ball, whatever it is, and I don't know, I find myself talking to people about how important it is to eat properly balanced meals with lots of good quality protein and fats and carbohydrates, and, you know, that we shouldn't be starting our day with a sugar bomb, you know, like sweet granola and drizzled honey and chopped up dates and fruit and stuff.
You're describing my breakfast from this morning, rather depressingly, all mixed in smoothies. So I think, aware.
You know, that's why I say it, because actually most people have that to start their day. And that's because we've been indoctrinated to believe that there are certain foods which are labeled as breakfast foods. And those foods are all like really dense carbohydrates, and I haven't got anything bad to say against carbohydrates, but, you know, toast and granola and porridge and pastries and coffee, you know, these are things that we assume we should be eating for breakfast, right? But if you consider that your body's just fasted for 10 plus hours overnight, you wake up in the morning, what it actually needs is the fundamental building blocks of health and of life, and that is protein, because we can't survive without protein. It builds every cell in our body. Healthy fats and like a rainbow of vegetables. So for me, a healthy breakfast is organic eggs and avocado and olive oil and sauerkraut and leafy greens or smoked salmon. breakfast is something I talk about with, I think, every patient, because it's such an easy swap to make. You know, that protein-based breakfast first thing in the morning will set you up to have a much balanced blood sugar throughout the day. And that in turn has really, really positive knock-on effects for our health.
Yeah, I know what I find interesting, and I wonder if you agree, is that I think we're woefully educated in terms of what food does to us, and all the way through. And it's we talked about education before, because it sort of underpins the first 15 to 20 years of our lives. And the impression I get is even I would count myself quite lucky with being told a lot while I was younger and having a good education. But I think I turned up at sort of 18, 19, 20 and assumed that Weetabix with low sugar on was a really healthy, balanced breakfast. And and generally, when you consider what we're fed at school up through our upbringing, it's really, really not great or balanced. And I think probably the biggest knock-on effect is that we don't really understand, until we speak to people like you or other experts, exactly what constitutes a good diet and what's going to help us function, especially when we start working and time becomes very short. I think most do you hear from a lot of people that, oh, but I don't have time to do that, and oh, my life is too busy? And how do you help people around that problem? Because obviously, we're talking about health, which is fundamentally, whatever people might say, the most important thing that we have. And yet a lot of the time, and I know I'm guilty of this, I would say, oh yeah, but I'm just gonna have that bar because it's quick and easy, and I don't have time to make my eggs in the morning and do all that, whereas I do, but I say I don't.
I think for the vast majority of people that definitely holds true, but the thing that's interesting about what I do is I see really sick people, not really sick, but they've come to me because they want to make a change. And usually they will be happy to kind of implement pretty much what I say. And so in terms of, making that change to swap to breakfast and, that are more nutrient dense, I don't have that much problem persuading people to do it, because they are really committed and really ready to make some serious life changes. It does happen, obviously. I see a lot of mums and they have super busy family lives. And, especially now in the mornings, one of the things I try and get people to do is get outside first in the morning to get some unadulterated daylight. And obviously it's quite dark in the mornings at the moment, and then you're rushing to get the kids to school. And, it's so much easier to just grab something really quick out of the fridge. But then it's a conversation about, okay, well, can we make something the night before? It doesn't have to be eggs, but say it's like a chia pudding or something that's, lovely, got lots of lovely omega fats in. You could put berries on the top. It doesn't have to be eggs and veggies every day. But it's interesting, isn't it? We all, I think these days, we all know a lot about food and a lot about nutrition, and or we think we do because we see it on social media. And actually, a lot of what I do and the way I like to kind of explain it to people is that it's so much more simple than you think. It doesn't have to be all of these health foods and superfoods and smoothies and, all of that. It's just eating real food that's properly nutrient dense, and doing that and showing up and doing that consistently. That's where the magic happens. It doesn't have to be like the newest, hottest cafe in London that's doing like acai bowls and all of that stuff. It's just simple, fundamental quality ingredients. And yeah, it's a little bit boring. Like, it's not sexy and exciting. It doesn't have to be complicated. And I think that's a really good takeaway for a lot of people.
Yeah, I love that. It's actually what we find with the with our podcast as well. There are so many sexy answers to mental health that people are trying to push out, but actually it's going for a walk, it's writing in a journal, it's having good relationships, which are all things that people are like, but I kind of had that, or I've tried to do that, and they just actually seem so simple that they can't be the answers to people's huge problems. So I can see a huge amount of relation in that. And it's so overwhelming, the amount of information that we are subject to, especially now on food and health. And I find that and this is what I wanted to ask, because you mentioned the mental aspect of what you do and how people's trauma or their mental health affects everything that's going on in their body as well. Mm. And I'd absolutely love to know, how that sort of ties in for you. What is the relationship? What are some of the main key things that have come up that you can advise people to work on that does have a big impact on their sort of their physical health?
I think, again, another really good question. I think a lot of what I talk about is carving out time for yourself during the day. You know, it doesn't have to be an hour and a half yoga class. It can literally be 5 minutes in the morning, 5 minutes at lunchtime, and 5 minutes before you go to bed of, you know, gentle 4-6 breathing. Or it can be a 20 minute walk in the morning. You know, it has to, I always find myself saying to people, which sounds a bit like, what's the word? I don't know, a bit kind of like wellnessy of me, let's say. But I always just think, you know, whatever you do in your life that brings you joy, just do that some more. Can we just do more of that, please? So even if it's like listening to podcasts, or having a little dance in the kitchen with your partner, or, you know, even just sitting quietly with a book or a cup of tea in the mornings, like, please just do it more. Because, you know, those pathways in the brain that are wired for happiness, and that dopamine and serotonin, you know, that's all part of a healing journey. Because it's really, really hard to make any kind of physiological change without the mental element being there as well. And actually, a lot of the times people have lost faith in the fact that their bodies can heal. And I think, you know, certainly in my own journey, that was a really, really powerful turning point for me, when it was actually my Chinese doctor who I've seen since I was 16. He's just the sweetest man, who does like massage and Chinese herbs and stuff. And he always has like nuggets of wisdom. And he said to me years ago that you have to get to a point where you believe that your body can heal, and then it will start to do that. Because if you are in that mindset where you feel like, you know, woe is me, you know, and I certainly was there, I was like, why am I the sick one? Like, why am I struggling? Why are my friends are able to have fun? And like, I eat so well, but I feel rubbish. And, you know, it's leaving all that behind and really trusting in the process, really trusting that your body wants to be better. Your body wants to be healthy. It's not doing this on purpose. And that actually, if you are experiencing symptoms, that's a really powerful message. Like, I've always suffered with really bad eczema. I don't have it anymore, which is amazing. But all throughout my life, since I was three, I had really chronic eczema. And I was so negative about that. And I was so hateful of my body that, you know, I suffer with this. And it was, you know, it was hard because it was, everyone else could see it. But actually, if you, for example, if you do suffer with a skin issue, that's a hugely powerful message that something's not right on the inside. And that's a lucky position to be in, because then you can make actionable changes. A lot of people have imbalances or health issues going on, and they don't have any outward signals. And that's a worse position to be in my view, because you understand less about what's going on. So it's really important to just reframe that thinking into a more positive place. And that's when you'll start to notice like actual real changes in your physical health. And I think it's often like strange to patients when I talk to them about this, because they're expecting me to just work on the physical stuff. You know, they're expecting me to do some gut testing or bloods, or, you know, run a hormone panel and then tell them what supplements to take and what they should be eating. And actually, sometimes I have to start way, way, way before that. If I notice that they're really down on themselves emotionally, then it's talking about things like time in nature and daylight exposure and mindfulness and journaling. It all has a place, I think.
Yeah. A very quick one on supplements, because they come up a little bit. And I just, what's your view on, you know, obviously the healthy balanced diet from normal sources of food is all probably ideal. But I mean, how often do you end up sort of advising people that certain supplements, depending on what they're deficient in, are beneficial? Is it more common than I probably think?
Yeah, all the time. Really? I pretty much don't see anyone that I don't prescribe something to. I do have, like, for example, at the moment, I have one patient who I haven't yet, because there was so much work to be done on a dietary level that, you know, and the basics had to be covered, that we're just starting there. We're just working on including like one different vegetable a week, or trying something new. And that's a real, you know, one end of the spectrum. Most people that I see already eat a really great diet. They've already tried everything. And you know, then we have to go in and do the kind of more complex stuff. But I think the thing to realize is that, you know, our food has changed. It's not as nutrient dense as it used to be.
Yeah.
Oftentimes it's covered in plastic, which comes with its own health concerns. It's not organic. It's covered in pesticide residues. You know, glyphosate is getting a lot of airtime at the moment because it is absolutely wreaking havoc on our health, and it's in all non-organic like grains and cereals. I remember, so my practitioner that I saw years ago when I kind of started off my own health journey, we were talking about glyphosate, which is Roundup. It's just a, you know, fertilizer.
Yeah.
And she was saying that she had seen a three-year-old girl, you know, like a super young patient, and done a urine test in her, and her glyphosate levels were through the roof. And, you know, she was saying to me that this is really impossible because at such a young age, she wouldn't have been able to necessarily accumulate that much of this particular toxin in her system. And that it must, and this is really shocking, it must have come through the placenta from the mother. And, you know, it's terrifying. You know, it's terrifying what's on our food. And I think, you know, it's not so much that people have nutrient deficiencies. It's more that they might need a particular nutraceutical or mineral or vitamin or, and like, you know, anything really to just help them switch on certain pathways in their body. You know, they might have sluggish detox, and they might respond well to something like glutathione, which is a really potent like liver support for detoxification. So it's not a sense of, oh, you're low in vitamin D, I'm going to supplement that. It's more like, how do we use clever supplementation to nudge your body in the right direction? It's not as simple as just taking a multivitamin. I do like people to get what they can from their diet. But the thing is that we don't, as humans these days, you know, we used to in the past, but we don't eat the most nutrient dense sources of food. You know, how often do you guys eat liver, for example? How often do you eat oysters or any other seafood? How often do you eat other, you know, organ meats and all this stuff? And actually, like, those are the dense, those are the like powerhouses, the natural multivitamins. And we don't eat those things. We go for like really bland chicken breasts, and you know, all of that doesn't, if you are eating a diet that is kind of like that, you know, you're having the same meals day in, day out, you're not really varying your food, you're not going for those dense sources of nutrition, then yeah, maybe you are going to be lacking. But if you eat as sensibly as you can and as nutritionally dense as you can, then hopefully there's no need for supplementation.
Yeah, and that's really interesting, and that's helpful. I know you can't say people should take this or that, but I guess it's seeking someone like your advice and saying, what am I deficient in? And it doesn't surprise me that we're now living in a in a much less nutrient dense world with everything that goes on. I wanted to ask quickly about snacking. Now I can't live without it. I eat too much, but it's just sort of do enough exercise to sort of counterbalance it. But what do you tend to tell your clients and the people that come to you for help about snacking?
So my first question would be, why do you think that you can't live without it? Okay. Why do you think that? You
can 7 hours. 7 hours between a meal is probably too much. And I start losing concentration. And I'm thinking about food.
Why would it be 7 hours though, between a meal?
So I might have lunch at one and then dinner at eight. Should I be shortening those gaps?
So my first thing would be, you're eating very late into the evening.
Yeah.
You know, the sun at the moment goes down about 4 p.m.
True.
Biologically speaking, mitochondrially speaking, we as humans are not primed to eat in darkness. You know, we live in accordance with the sun. So I would be shifting your dinner significantly earlier, 7 p.m., you know, latest, because you want to have a good 3 hours between dinner and going to bed so that you're properly digested and you have optimum sleep. And then I would be looking at, okay, well, what are you having for lunch? Is it dense enough? Like, have you got enough protein? Have you got enough fat? Have you got enough rainbow vegetables? And then thinking, okay, well, if you do need to snack, like say, for example, you're late at work and you have to eat dinner at 8.
Yeah.
What are you having? What are you snacking on?
A protein shake or if I'm feeling really down, probably a chocolate bar. It would be my treat. And I know deep down it's not probably the best thing for me, but it's just, you know, find myself lacking in concentration if I don't eat. And no, you're absolutely right. And I know the biggest thing I've noticed recently is I eat so late that sometimes I struggle to sleep, and I'm pretty sure they're related. But again, it's just, you know, sometimes you need to work it out for yourself. And and sometimes, you know, if you're doing exercise, or you, as you say, you're working late, then doing exercise, you can't eat before, and you end up eating at 9 or 10. And I know it's not healthy. And I guess it's so finding balance.
So I think a few things there, and I will answer your question properly now rather than just like
putting
you under the spotlight. A few things there is that in an ideal world, we would exercise in the morning, in the daylight hours. Again, like that's what we are best primed to do from a standpoint of nature and evolution. You know, you wake up, you get outside first thing, you get that daylight, you do your exercise. And then to answer your question properly, I don't really have a problem with snacking. I have a problem with what people are snacking on. So if you are finding that you cannot get through the day without something like a little treat, like something a bit sweet, you know, if at 3 or 4 p.m. you are completely on the floor energy-wise and you're having that mid-afternoon slump at work, and you all you feel can get you through is like a coffee or like a chocolate bar or something, then there's an issue with blood sugar there. Like 100% there's an issue with blood sugar. If you are doing a really demanding job, you know, the brain takes up a huge amount of our energy. If you're doing a really demanding job or a lot of physical activity, you may need to snack because you actually just need those calories. But it's looking at what are you snacking on. So instead of having a pastry or something like that's like healthy but actually just full of sugar, you know, can you have celery sticks dipped in nut butter, or can you have hummus and maybe some oat cakes? Can you have like a piece of cheese? Like, can you have protein and fat? Because protein and fat is what's going to keep you full, and it's what's going to keep your blood sugar nice and balanced. If you are ravenously hungry and you're going for the biscuit tin, then 2 hours later, you're going to be ravenously hungry again. Your blood sugar is going to have dipped. You're going to feel terrible. So it's not the snacking that I have a problem with. It's what we are snacking on.
Interesting. No, I think it's really useful. And again, I'm so conscious and aware of it, and I notice it affecting me. But sometimes it's just hearing it from someone else, because you don't tend to listen to your own head when it's telling you that something isn't working. But no, thank you. And apologies for putting you on the spot, because I know that everyone
is slightly different. I put you on the spot. It's fine.
No, good. I guess one of the final things I just want to ask is, if you don't mind, can you take me through a typical day of what you might eat, breakfast, lunch and dinner, snacking if possible? I know, like, again, this is why the first question I ask is everyone's different, and I get that, especially in quantity terms and what their body might need. But just interested to sort of frame what a sort of normal diet day looks like for you.
Yeah, sure. And yeah, like you said, everyone's different. Anyone that's listening to this, please don't take this as gospel. So at the moment, and also I'm not perfect, I'm very good at dishing out advice, but like you said, sometimes it's hard to take your
I think we're all
so I usually wake up quite early at the moment, and it's still dark, which is really depressing, and the first thing I do is I get up and I hydrate. So I have some water. At this time of year, I try and drink warm water rather than cold water. And then I will have a coffee, typically decaf. And I usually put like a tiny bit of normal caffeinated coffee in there. And I'll either have that black, or if I'm feeling like I fancy it, I'll have it with oat milk. And then breakfast will be always for me 2 organic eggs, usually scrambled with grass-fed butter. And then I'll put like a sauerkraut or a kimchi, and then some leafy greens. If I fancy it, I might have some sourdough or like a gluten-free, not gluten-free bread in the sense of like the stuff that you buy in the supermarket because it's all full of sugar. But there are a few out there that I really rate, or I might have a piece of that. And then usually after breakfast, I have some 90% dark chocolate because I love chocolate. And when you're getting like percentages as high as like 90% or 85%, there's really very little sugar in it. Full disclosure, at the moment, we do have some Christmas panettone in the house, and it's very nice with a cup of coffee. So on occasion, I've been having some of that. And then lunchtime, today, for example, I've got some leftover soup that I made at the weekend with, I usually roast a chicken at the weekend, and then I boil the bones to make bone broth, and then I make like a vegetable soup with that bone broth. So it's got onions and garlic and leeks and carrots, leafy green veg, bone broth, red split lentils, herbs, spices. I just cook that up. So I'll probably have that for lunch today. And I might have some cheese with it, or I might have some sardines, because you always need to have your protein. And then in the afternoon, I'll likely have like an apple or an orange and maybe a teaspoon of almond butter if I'm hungry. If I've got a super busy day on, or if I've exercised, I might have some oat cakes and some hummus. And then this evening, I think I'm going to make bolognese. So organic beef bolognese, again, loads of veggies in there, cook it up for a nice long time. And then I'll be having that with brown rice pasta, Parmesan cheese, and probably some cavolo nero or some kale, or I think I've got some tender stem broccoli in the fridge as well. And I'll probably also have some more chocolate at some point during the day. So I eat quite a lot. I always have done. And I'm not a saint. You know, I will, like last night after supper, my husband and I had a mince pie. I'm not a saint, but I know I'll never go a day without getting all the nutrients in, as well as maybe, you know, if I'm having something naughty like it's Christmas. But I will always have had my leafy greens, a rainbow of vegetables, you know, something from every color of the rainbow, good quality sources of protein and lots of healthy fats. And that's pretty much it. That's like the formula, I think.
Yeah, it's interesting. The two things I take away: one is you've made me really, really hungry now, and it's 11 a.m. here when we're recording it. But you've got me quite excited about the idea of vegetable bone broth soup. And the other one is, I guess you're not skimping at all, and you know there's a lot.
Oh my god, no! I eat so much. Yeah,
no, it's such an important thing to remember, and there's that, and also just the range, and also there's nothing there that screams this is going to take you ages to make.
No, especially not longer.
And I guess, you know, the terrible thing about, you know, we're in London where the options are so huge and lockdown's been terrible because Deliveroo is just around the corner, or, you know, Uber Eats or whatever you might need. And you've got your takeaway, you know, on call, and it's almost now the same price, especially if you want to eat well and eat healthy. So yeah, it's quite reassuring to listen to all that. I mean, I don't know if Alexia has anything to add, but I guess the final sort of thing I wanted to ask was, you know, if you had to just sort of highlight the 3 or 4 or 5 principles to sort of live by from a nutritional perspective, what would they be? Because I think that for me is the most useful thing. As you say, you know, unless people have the money or the time, they might go to someone like you for a real prescription of this is what you need. But generally, it sounds like you can stick to some principles and some real fundamentals that should then help guide what we go and put into our body.
So interestingly, I think
No, I was going to say, just to add to that, and perhaps things that aren't necessarily nutritional, but are daily routines that you have, such as, you know, I know that you do this sort of swim in the sea thing and cold water exposure, but also, you know, natural sunlight and things like you've mentioned. So I think it's really, really valuable if you can add them in or mix them.
So that's actually what I was about to say, that, you know, my main advice probably isn't what we're putting into our bodies, it's what we're surrounding ourselves and what we're doing on a daily basis. So a few simple things that people can take away that will really, really, truly make a huge, huge impact on their health are daylight exposure as much as you can. Definitely first thing in the morning when you wake up, definitely some point around lunchtime, you know, noon or 1 o'clock, so that you're getting the signaling to the brain via the changes in light across the whole day. And then again, as the sun's going down, getting outside, even if it's just 10 minutes. You know, we are regulated by the sun, and our human biology is most optimal, most effective when we're living in accordance with nature. So getting that signaling first thing in the morning, lunchtime, evening, just some daylight exposure. The second thing is wearing a pair of really good quality blue blocking glasses at nighttime. And I'm talking about glasses that have red lenses, so that when you actually look through them, you cannot see the color blue. So when I watch TV at night, I have these on, really sexy glasses. And when I look through these, I can't see any blue light. And the reason for that is sleep. So sleep is probably definitely one of the most fundamental things we can all do for our health, getting good quality sleep. And melatonin, which I'm sure you guys will know, is the hormone that makes us feel sleepy, is actually created in the morning, which is why getting outside first thing in the morning is so important. It's then stored throughout the day. And then when we get that signal to the brain that the light is fading, i.e. sunset, it starts getting released. So what then happens in modern day society is that the sun goes down, it's dark outside, but we're inside our houses with loads of blue light. And it's the blue light that is going to keep us awake, and it's going to stop that melatonin from being released. So you want to get some really good quality blue blockers, and you want to dim the lights in your house and everything so that you have a really good night's sleep. And when you sleep well, your immune system's stronger, your detoxification works optimally. You know, it's beneficial for every aspect of our health. So the whole light aspect is a huge one. And then the second thing would be, you know, anything that you can do to reduce stress in your life is going to positively impact your health on a really, really fundamental level. So whatever that is for you, whether it's exercise, whether it's walks in nature, whether it's a dance class, whether it's, you know, 10 minutes journaling in the morning, reducing stress in our, you know, our modern day society where we are absolutely bombarded with stresses is really important. And then, yeah, I suppose diet is a huge one, you know, but it's simple, it's nutrient dense, it's eating what's in season, it's going for those foods that are packed with what we need as humans rather than, you know, limp cold salads in the middle of winter or smoothie bowls full of tropical fruit that we actually don't grow in this country. You know, quality sources of protein, loads and loads of great healthy fats, you know, the omegas from oily fish, and then a rainbow of vegetables. You know, when you get to the end of the day, think to yourself, have I eaten one thing from every color of the rainbow today? And if I have, great. And then tomorrow, if you had aubergine for your purple food, the next day, can you eat blackberries or something else that's purple? And building in that diversity of diet is really important. So yeah, I think, you know, light, sleep, stress, food, super simple, but will all make a really, really huge impact on your health.
No, thank you for that. What's so interesting is that the first three weren't directly related to food, which I think is fascinating. And it's just shows you how interlinked they all are. But no, thank you so much, Grace. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on. I've learned a lot. And I've also, I only had breakfast about an hour and a half ago, and I'm hungry already for lunch. I think it's all this talk about food. So thank you so much for joining us. I have to admit, you now got the sun and some vitamin D shining on your face. It looks a lot more pleasant where you are in Cornwall than where we are in London. So I am quite jealous.
Yeah, it's a glorious day. So I'm going to go and get outside and make the most of it.
Perfect. Well, thanks so much for joining us, and
thank you for having me.
Recommend everyone check out Grace's podcast. Also, her website has some really useful blogs and bits of information as well, just on nutrition and all the stuff she's talked about today in a bit more detail. But yeah, thanks for joining us, Grace.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Mindfield Pod. Please don't forget to subscribe, rate, and get in touch. We all have our own minefields, and we hope that this podcast goes some way to helping you navigate yours.